everybody here really understands that it wasn't just a viral pandemic. There was a social justice pandemic. There was a mental health pandemic. There was all sorts of things that were a consequence of this viral infection. Even though I'm really best at being a biologist and immunologist and viruses and lymphocytes, the thing that became so obvious and was so painful during that 2 years is that there was just a failure to achieve access and uptake of the vaccines to all the places that needed to be helped by the vaccine.
Presenting Danforth Dialogues, a monthly podcast on leadership, hosted by Morehouse School of Medicine President and CEO, Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice. This month, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Barney Graham, Morehouse School of Medicine Senior Advisor of Global Health Equity. Dr. Graham is a renowned medical researcher and played a key role in helping to develop vaccines for RSV and coronavirus while at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Graham and Dr. Montgomery Rice will discuss the efforts to produce vaccines, global health equity, and the COVID-19 pandemic in today's podcast. Now, for this month's podcast, here's Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice.
Welcome to Danforth Dialogues. As you know, each month we bring you leadership insights from a wide range of guests. And today I am joined by one of the country's leading immunologists and virologists, and proud to say our own Dr. Barney Graham. If you've been keeping up with the news about RSV in recent months or COVID-19, there's a good chance that you may have heard from this medical expert. He has really been on the scene, given insights into the disease and its impact on children. Last year, after retiring as the deputy director of the NIH Vaccine Research Center, we were fortunate enough to entice him to join our faculty. Welcome to Danforth Dialogues, Dr. Graham.
Thank you, Dr. Montgomery Rice. It's my pleasure to be here.
So as one of the country's leading medical researchers, I thought we would start by having you give us a bit of background on your career journey, starting from that little place in Kansas, I think, and tell us why you chose to spend your life working in healthcare and discovery.
I grew up in small town Kansas, eastern part of Kansas, and some of that experience was on a farm where we raised horses, cows, pigs, and a lot of crops to feed them. And I ended up at Rice University in Houston, Texas, out of that setting in Paola, Kansas. And I was very fortunate to get to Rice because the academic rigor at a place like that really changed my whole life and perspective on things. And I had a biochemistry professor there, James Walker, who once told me that if you enjoy learning, enjoy reading, enjoy any of the things that we did at Rice, that you were accumulating a debt. And that debt could only be paid by writing, studying, and discovering, and adding back to the overall knowledge base. And that really, I think, changed the trajectory of my life, starting out as wanting to be a math teacher to wanting to go to medical school.
And you did go to medical school.
I went to medical school at the University of Kansas.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you at the Wichita campus or were you at the main campus?
Well, the main campus for the first 2 years, but then to the Wichita campus. And I met my wife there, Dr. Cynthia Turner Graham. We met in the sophomore year during physical diagnosis. Mm-hmm. We were next to each other in line and got
But you weren't off. Doing the physical diagnosis on each other?
No.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah, not until after. So you don't have to record that. But we married just before the end of medical school. At that time, KU was a 3-year medical school.
That's right.
And because of my experience at Rice, I didn't want to learn that fast. And so I ended up taking about 9 months out to do research with Dr. Al Chapman there. Mm-hmm. And that was my first exposure to virology. And it extended my medical school time to 4 years instead of 3. And so Cynthia and I finished the same time and then went to Vanderbilt. I went to Vanderbilt. She went to Meharry and started. I started in internal medicine. She started in pediatrics. Later, transferred to Vanderbilt for a psychiatry residency, and we were then there for 21 years. Mm-hmm. Before the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Fauci and Bill Clinton agreed that they would build a facility on the NIH campus that was multidisciplinary as a new effort to try to solve the HIV crisis and make an HIV vaccine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a longer story that would be interesting to tell, but about how that happened in the Oval Office. It was a short tutorial on the new co-receptor for HIV that had been discovered in 1995 or 6 and led to some of the new drugs that were available at that time to finally change treatment of HIV. But during that session where Dr. Fauci was teaching Bill Clinton about the co-receptor, the question was asked about, what do you really need to solve the HIV problem? Mm-hmm. And so Dr. Fauci had an answer. He said, we need to make a vaccine. Well, what do you need to make a vaccine? We need this multidisciplinary unit. And so he knew what he needed to be successful. This is one of the lessons I try to tell students is if somebody asks you what you want, you need to have an answer. Mm-hmm. Right away. Mm-hmm. And he did. And a couple years later, at the Morgan State commencement, President Clinton announced this new program, this new center for vaccine research. And so we moved there in 2001 when the center opened and were there for 21 years. And then we moved here. Very glad to be here.
Well, we're happy you're here. But I want to take us back a little bit because my first job out of residency fellowship was at the University of Kansas. I started the division of reproductive endocrinology and fertility, and I had the opportunity to spend time in Wichita because we sort of shared the REI division together there. I wanted you to tell us a little bit about some of the things that maybe happened in your childhood or when you were making this decision to go to medical school that really sort of affirmed to you what was the opportunity to recognize you were accumulating this debt and how you would pay it back to society?
On the farm, biology is everywhere, all around you. So the animal biology, just nature, all these things, feed into your spirit. And so I was just very curious about life and what made life work. And finally, I got into the biology program at Rice, and that's what led me to medical school. But medicine offers you a lot of opportunities, not just to be a physician to care for people, but it gives you opportunities. If you can become a physician, you'll never be lacking for a job. Mm-hmm. Because you can take care of patients directly. You can become an administrator. You can become a teacher. You can become a scientist. You can become almost anything in life is fed by the medical education. So choosing to be a physician gave me a lot of options, and I was interested in biology and helping people. And so it was a good fit for me.
And so you went into internal medicine, did a residency in internal medicine. Now, did you have your research ongoing at that point? Because at some point, I don't know if we were we called clinician scientists at that point?
No.
What were we called back then, other than nerds?
Well, at Kansas, for somebody who wanted to be a scientist and to be an academician, the logical choice would have been to stay in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's where the professors were and the academicians were. But maybe because of my farm experience and just wanting to learn things on my own, I chose Wichita because at the time there was about 150 students in Kansas City and there weren't really enough patients available between mm-hmm. the university center and the VA for all those students to have a robust experience. And so I decided I would rather have the patient experiences where there was 2,500 patients for 50 students in Wichita and use the medical literature and the books and the patient experiences to train and teach myself. And there were also good professors in Wichita, but it wasn't associated with an academic track. Mm-hmm. So I know we're going to eventually get to science here, but getting from Wichita to Vanderbilt in Nashville. That's its story unto itself. And because I, during those last couple of months of medical school, I had taken some external rotation. I did 9 months of research and 3 months of extra rotations outside of Kansas. And two of those months were at NIH in the Walter Reed Medical Center across the street in Bethesda. And at that time, I was a fourth-year medical student, and Dr. Fauci was one of my attendings when I was doing the infectious disease rotation at NIH. And at that time, he was a specialist in vasculitis and Wegener's granulomatosis, things like that, and hadn't really made much of inroads into infectious diseases because this was before HIV. And then I was at UNC for a month. But on the way back, we were having a hard time figuring out how to match. And we had interviewed at several places and in the Midwest, and some places like me and some places like Cynthia, but nobody.
And you were doing couples match at that time.
We were, it was the very beginning of the couples match. And we couldn't really find a place that wanted both of us. And so she said, I have an idea. When you're coming back, driving back from UNC back to Wichita, why don't you stop in Nashville? Or she said, why don't you interview at Vanderbilt? And maybe you could go to Vanderbilt. I could go to Meharry because I have some connections there. And so I said, well, where's Vanderbilt? And she said, it's in Nashville. Just stop in Nashville and see what you can do. And so I stopped there on Christmas Eve in 1978. And the residency director, the department chair of medicine, and the chief resident were all in their offices. And I went in and filled out the paperwork in the secretary's office and was able to interview with all three of those people on Christmas Eve. And by the end of the day, Dr. Brittingham, who was the residency director at the time, had given me an assurance that if Vanderbilt was the only place I put on my match list, that he would.
Now, I don't know that that's legal anymore to do that. You know that, right? I'm just letting the audience know that.
But I'm well past that now. Unfortunately, Dr. Brittingham's no longer with us. But Dr. Brittingham was a unique man and unique individual that made this life we had together in Nashville possible.
And I know that we are a little bit away from science, but I think it's important that our young people who are listening to your story understand that you don't just wake up like this. You don't just wake up with ending up at the NIH. There's a pathway that we all go through. And sometimes it does require a pathway that has not been traveled. Taking time to do your fourth year, doing mostly research. In my fourth year of medical school, I spent 10 months doing basic science research and did not do any external rotations. And I, you know, never regretted that. But it led me to the path of being a clinician scientist. And so following your passion and your heart sometimes gets you to the right place with your head. So thank you for sharing that part of you, because it matters also. So let's get to the science. You were at the NIH. You were the deputy director of this new center that had been formed in the Oval Office. I didn't know about that part in the Oval Office. You have been working with lots of different people who have come through the center. So what was it like, I guess, in, I'm going to say, about December 2019, when you started to see that maybe it's something that you have been working on for the last 15 years may actually prove to be of some unique value?
Yes. So the pathway to getting to NIH was also unpredictable, or unimaginable in some ways, because I was interested in academics, and I did some, you know, case reports and things like that, paper writing at Vanderbilt. And but my faculty time at Vanderbilt was spent after fellowship and the PhD program really working on respiratory syncytial virus in the laboratory starting around 1985, and also then other viral diseases. But I helped Dr. Wright time to initiate the first HIV clinical trials unit back in 1987. So I was the only internist involved with a group of other virologists in pediatrics, and he needed an internist to be part of that. Mm-hmm. And then he took a sabbatical to Geneva, WHO, to do polio eradication. And I was left there with an HIV unit. And so those last several years at Vanderbilt, I was doing basic research, but also clinical trials research. And I was recruited to the Vaccine Research Center to set up their clinical trials program. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't go unless they allowed me to keep my lab. And so I did have the viral pathogenesis lab in addition to that. And during those years, leading up to the events of 2020, I trained a number of people. One of those persons took over the clinical program in 2013, mm-hmm. about the time we were making some breakthroughs with respiratory syncytial virus. And we were finally able to capture some of the atomic level structures of the surface proteins of RSV in 2012, published in 2013. And then it revealed a lot of things about what had happened in the past with RSV biology. But the important thing that happened from that was that we learned that if you could stabilize protein, the F protein that results in fusion and viral entry, if you could stabilize it in its pre-fusion conformation, that it would become a better vaccine antigen because it preserved a lot of surfaces at the top of that molecule that are where it's most vulnerable to neutralization by antibodies. Mm-hmm. And so if that surface could be preserved, you would elicit the right antibodies to make more potent neutralization. And that's the key to having an effective vaccine. So that finding in 2013 and the release of the clinical responsibilities to my young protege, who was better at it than I was anyway, allowed me to then work more on laboratory issues related to making better viral vaccine antigens, especially for envelope viruses with these class 1 fusion proteins. Mm-hmm. And so in 2013, when Jason McClellan, the student I was working with who was in Peter Kwong's lab on the RSV, went to Dartmouth, we agreed that we needed to extend these observations and into other envelope viruses. And we chose coronaviruses because that was a virus family that had caused problems in 2002 and 3 with the first SARS.
Mm-hmm. With SARS.
And right in the middle of our RSV work, MERS coronavirus came up. That was a problem we had to react to. And so two coronavirus events in 10 years suggested this was going to be an
important virus. Now, how many coronaviruses are there now that we know of?
Well, there is dozens and dozens of coronaviruses that infect all sorts of different animals. There's mm-hmm. only four known endemic coronaviruses at the time. There's two beta and two alpha coronaviruses that infect people every winter season, and mm-hmm. and they're usually causing the common cold,
okay.
and they're not really paid attention to much. So a lot of people asked us why we were working on a virus that doesn't really matter that much.
Mm-hmm.
But we wanted to prove this idea that stabilizing fusion proteins, in the case of coronavirus, it's called a spike protein, would make a better vaccine antigen. And so by 2016, we had the first structure of a human beta coronavirus spike protein from the HKE1 virus, one of the endemic coronaviruses. And by the next year, we knew how to stabilize it by changing some things inside to keep the surface together.
And now, you're not at this point, though, anticipating a pandemic. You're just doing what we consider science.
This is all science. And
okay.
it's really just trying to understand what fusion proteins look like and how they work and where antibodies bind and how they neutralize the virus. It's all about basic research. And Dr. Corbett, who had started with me in high school and for 4 years worked with me on and off in the lab before she went to UNC for her graduate program,
mm-hmm.
she decided to come back to me in 2014. Instead of going to another place in California, she decided to come back, and she was interested in the coronavirus projects.
Okay.
And so
okay.
since 2014, Dr. Corbett came back and was very involved in our work on understanding coronavirus biology and immunology and immunity.
Now, at this point, was she in graduate school? She had finished
graduate school? She was a postdoc.
She was a postdoc. So she came back to you, and instead of going out to some place in California, maybe Stanford or UC San Francisco, one of those places, she chose to come to work with you. Okay.
Right. I don't want to tell that person directly that she lost her. For that. But so for those next several years, we were responding to MERS and chikungunya in 2012. We were working in the lab on RSV and coronavirus. Then in 2014, we were responding to Ebola. And 2016, to Zika. And, you know, we were just exhausted. Every other year, there was a major pandemic threat that the VRC, because of its resources, was expected to respond to. And so a lot of things came together around those years between 2014 and 16 in our thinking about how to be more proactively prepared for new pandemic threats. And, you know, WHO and CDC would make a list of a few pathogens, but we thought that you needed a better plan that covered all the potential viral pathogens. At that time, there was 24 viral families. Now there's 27 because of taxonomic changes. But the idea was to really look at all the 27 viral families that can infect humans and identify prototype pathogens or prototype viruses that represent those groups, and then develop generalizable solutions for those different groups of viruses. And so the prototype pathogen plan for pandemic preparedness is something we had written about and talked about and then formalized in a paper in 2017 or 18, describing the concept. And NIAID adopted that plan for the larger NIAID. And so that was happening. We were also thinking about how to go. We were always thinking about how to go faster. We've used genetic or gene-based vaccine approaches for a lot of these different outbreaks along the way, and mostly using DNA and other vectors. But in 2016, during Zika, when we made a DNA vaccine, we were also testing the other vaccines from other companies in our animal models and found that we tested mRNA from three different companies, including Moderna. And a few years earlier, we worked with Moderna because they were interested in our RSV vaccine. But at that time, their RNA wasn't working that well. But in 2016, we found that their RNA at that point was way better than our DNA. So 4 milligrams of DNA was like 30 micrograms of RNA, and with the same basic construct. So we were thinking about this rapid manufacturing approach. We were thinking about precision antigen design, and we wanted to bring all those to bear on this pandemic preparedness project. So in 2017, we made a deal with Moderna, a formal research collaboration agreement, to work on two major viral families, the paramyxoviruses and the coronaviruses, using Nipah as the prototype for paramyxos and MERS coronavirus as the prototype. And by the end of 2019, this is a long answer to you.
It is a long answer, but I'm following the science. I hope the audience is.
By the end of 2019, we had antigen designs for Nipah and antigen designs for the stabilized spike for MERS that we had shown already that either the protein version or the mRNA version could protect animals from lethal challenge in ferrets for the Nipah and mice for the MERS coronavirus. And so we were already prepared with this pandemic preparedness demonstration project. And in 2019, we in fact had meetings with Moderna and Dr. Fauci, who allowed us to trigger this trial that we were going to do in the first quarter of 2020. John Mascola and I had already visited the new Moderna plant in Norwood, near Boston, verify that it was an adequate manufacturing facility, and it was state-of-the-art, brand new. And we were going to start a Nipah mRNA clinical trial in the first quarter of 2020. We'd already pulled all those triggers and made all those plans, and all the money was already sitting there to do that. And so then, on the last day of the year, we heard about this new outbreak in China. And on the 6th of January, we heard that it was a beta coronavirus through the grapevine. And so Stefan and Boncel and I were on the phone, and we agreed that instead of paramyxoviruses, we should probably do our demonstration project on coronavirus, even though at that time there had not been a case of infection in the United States. And the pandemic wasn't declared until a couple months later. But it still made more sense to do something that was in real time happening, and instead of just going as fast as you could for abstract reason. So we agreed. He said, as soon as you get the sequence and give us the sequence, the design for the protein, we'll make the RNA, and then you can do what you do. And so on the 10th, we got the sequences. We designed the
reagents. And you got sequence from Wuhan?
We got sequence from China. It was the Wuhan sequences. It was the first six sequences released from China that Friday evening.
And that did make a difference to have universal access to
that. We had to get the sequences.
Right.
Earlier that day, I had emailed George Gao, who's the head of the China CDC, and because we'd worked together on coronavirus. He was also interested in coronavirus even before it became a thing. And I told him, you know, this is not just your problem. This is everybody's problem. Mm-hmm. And we really, really need those sequences. And he said, I'm trying to get them released. And then later that day, there they were. They came out about 8 o'clock on Friday night. And so we designed the reagents we needed. We then within about 2 weeks were able to make protein designed with the 2-proline substitution that we had figured out for the MERS coronavirus spike. And within a few days after that, Jason McClellan, now at UT Austin, was able to solve the structure of spike with his cryo-EM. And we were able to start making immune assays and immunizing mice. And Moderna got us back mRNA within about 24 days. And so by 42 days in, we already had immunogenicity data in mice for both protein and mRNA. And mRNA looked pretty good.
So let's talk about the we. Who was in the lab at that time? Because you and I kind of know the answer to that. So tell us about the we. So we all have heard about Dr. Corbett. And we knew that you were her mentor. She had been your postdoc student. But there were actually some other people in the laboratory
who were
benefited from this new knowledge that was being gained.
Right, exactly. And so Dr. Corbett was working in the lab, but she was also taking on responsibility for training young people. We at NIH, we call them ERTAs, Intramural Research Training Awardees. These are people who finished undergrad and are looking forward to either graduate school or medical school and wanting to improve their credentials and things like that. And so we were having a lot of fun. And Dr. Corbett was the one who organized the calls with our academic collaborators. That was Ralph Barrick at UNC and Mark Dennison at Vanderbilt. They each have been involved in coronavirus work many, many decades. And Jason McClellan and Andrew Ward at Scripps. So this consortium of academic sites and the industry collaborator Moderna were in organized calls every couple of months to carry out this coronavirus project. And so not only had Dr. Corbett organized a lot of that work between the academic and industry collaborators, but had brought along a couple of other students from UMBC. Some of them were from UMBC and the Meyerhoff Scholarship program has been so successful. But by the time we really got into the work in mid-January of 2020, the student who'd been with us the longest, Olu Abiona, who's now an MD PhD student at Case Western.
At Case Western,
And Cynthia Zawawo, who was a Spelman grad and is now a medical student at Indiana. And then Jeffrey Hutchison, who was another student that I had in the lab working on influenza, moved over to the coronavirus team. And he's now a grad student at University of Washington in Seattle. But those four young people really did most of the bench work to make the protein, to get the mice immunized, to get things sent off for structure. All that work had to be done at the bench in the middle of a pandemic when all the labs at NIH were being shut down and when you were at infection risk just by coming to work on the bus or any other way and working through scares of coronavirus, having to get the whole lab dusted down with vaporized hydrogen peroxide, all these things that we were doing initially that may not be necessary now, but, we were doing all these things trying to just keep the work going.
Did you know how important what you were doing at that point? Did you know that it would really change the trajectory of life and the opportunity to keep people safe with the development of this vaccine? Did you know that it would have this impact?
At that time, you know, we were dedicated to the mission of proving that we could, by better basic research preparation, better responses to pandemic threats. Even by the end of February, there had only been one or two cases in the U.S. So a lot of this was just, dedication to the mission of showing that the new technologies we have access to now really give us an opportunity to do better and to go faster with more precision and just have better vaccines if needed. And it really wasn't until around mid-February when it was clear in the U.S. that this was spreading. And so about a little over a month into it is when it really became clear this is not just a drill. This is not just a demonstration project. This is the real deal. And we've got to keep pressing. And so, we had immunology data in the animals by day 42 and had engaged other parts of NIAID and DMID, the extramural networks with the clinical trials groups, including the Division of AIDS with the whole HVTN, and engaged them to help us get a phase one trial done quickly. We were going to do the phase one trial ourselves, and we had the clinic to do that, but to go quickly, and it was becoming a bigger thing, we decided to reach out and get help from all the resources around us. And so the phase one trial was started in about 65 days. Some people don't know this, that BioNTech was also working on this mRNA technology, and both BioNTech and Moderna had developed their companies really with the same basic concept that modified nucleotides made RNA work better. And that's how they raised the money and started all their work initially on cancer vaccines. BioNTech, Ugar Sahin called me around the end of January and said, you know, we're going to make a vaccine for this virus, and what do you think we should put in it? And I said, well, just put prolines at 986 and 987, and it should work just fine. And so BioNTech had started early, but it wasn't until the day after we started that phase one clinical trial, we started on the 16th of March, that Pfizer bought the franchise to mRNA and BioNTech. They announced that deal on the 17th of March. I'm not going to speculate, but, you know, maybe they didn't think mRNA was really something that could go all the way, and they didn't want to invest until they saw the FDA let us really get that trial started. So anyway, within 2 months, Pfizer and BioNTech had started their phase one trial, and then by the end of July, they caught up with us. Both started the phase three trials on the same day, July 27th.
And that really did change things. And you talked about this science that you were doing was really focused on your mission, and you were trying to prepare for the next pandemic, not knowing when it was going to come, but just an evolution of science. So when you think about mission, and at Morehouse School of Medicine, you know our mission is leading the creation and advancement of health equity. Understanding now what you know about vaccines and the opportunities that these vaccines presented for saving lives, how do we now move into the future of achieving health equity, or democratizing the opportunity for vaccine development in low-income resource countries? And why would that matter?
Right. So the coronavirus pandemic, I think everybody here really understands that it wasn't just a viral pandemic. There was a social justice pandemic. There was a mental health pandemic. There was all sorts of things that were a consequence of this viral infection. Even though I'm really best at being a biologist and immunologist and viruses and lymphocytes, the thing that became so obvious and was so painful during that 2 years is that there was just a failure to achieve access and uptake of the vaccines to all the places that needed to be helped by the vaccines. And it was painful to see that in the presence and all the confluence of all the social justice issues and protests that were happening all during that same time. And I was, I was near the end of a 40-year career in science and laboratory work, and I wanted to spend more time, even though I'm not an expert in this, to see how I can impact or change access and uptake to vaccines or other medical care, you know, to other medical care resources, and how can you make that more equitable? And Morehouse School of Medicine is the champion of equity, and it's even in your mission statement, and it's about everything you do. We had already agreed to move to Atlanta.
And there were some other people wooing you, though.
We came a year late because I just had to get to a stopping point. And by the time I left, the RSV vaccines were already launched by the big pharma companies. And the coronavirus vaccine, to everybody in the world was working on this at this point. And they didn't really need me anymore. I wanted the young people at VRC to have the chance to make their own decisions and spend the money with their own ideas. And so I felt like it was time for me to move on. And finally, a year later than we had hoped for in our 2020 plan, we decided to move to Atlanta to be closer to grandchildren. Our influenza program had kind of reached a stopping point as well. So we got here, and I said, if I really want to do this kind of work, I need to be working with people who know what they're doing. And so one of the reasons I wanted to be at Morehouse is because you are the equity champions. And I think I already know that I can learn a lot from you. I've learned a lot already. I've only been here a few months, but and I haven't really even met everyone. But I know this is the right place for me to be.
Well, we are excited that we were able to align with your passion and your purpose. And we know that we have a strong commitment to democratization of opportunities for vaccine manufacturing and development in low-income resource countries, because I think you and I have had multiple conversations about that is how you really prepare for the next pandemic, is that there has to be a local and a regional focus and not the dependency on someone feeling good,
right,
and making a decision to share. But we know that if we put science in the hands of people, right, knowledge will follow.
Exactly. And so one of the obvious consequences of all this thinking and planning for pandemic preparedness is that all pandemic threats start as regional problems.
That's right.
Even HIV was a regional problem in Central Africa until it was unrecognized for several decades and then spread around the world. So solving regional problems, most of which are in low and middle income countries, mm-hmm. is in the best interest of everyone, including the high income countries. And the best way to solve those regional problems is to put the capabilities and technologies into the hands of regional investigators so that Kenyans can solve Rift Valley fever, and Nigerians can solve Lassa fever, and Australians can solve Ross River Valley virus infections, and Mexicans can solve the Maiora virus. And all of these things are pandemic threats that will not be addressed by publicly held companies in Western industrialized high-income countries, because it's not going to satisfy stockholder requirements. And so this work has to be done by governments, hopefully in a large multinational consortium and agreement, maybe 194 country accord like we have for climate change, by academics, by philanthropists, and by a few of the rare privately held companies like Serum Institute of India, who are willing to make things even at a loss to satisfy the needs of low and middle income countries. And and I think there's a real opportunity now with mRNA, because it's like cell phones jumped over two generations of laying cable in the ground technology.
Right.
And now between 2020 and 2000 and 2020, telecommunication technology in Africa is almost caught up to all the rest of the world because of that jump in technology. And so mRNA is a chemical synthesis approach. You don't need a whole campus full of bioreactors. Mm-hmm. It's something that is relatively simple. It has a small footprint. It's small batch type of technology that could be transported into low and middle income country settings. even in a modular containment unit, you could put some relatively small equipment to make RNA. And if you had that rapid iterative design cycle type of technology in the hands of people who really care about what's happening around them, they can solve their regional problem. And and then in some cases, some of those areas that develop enough of the expertise and enough of the human capital who can be trained to do this work, you can have manufacturing. And then you can manufacture and take care of your own population for your own regional problems before they become global problems.
And you might just create equity, huh?
And giving people what they need. And I think that leads to equity. And,
yeah.
And so the question is, can you help teach me how to make the arguments in a setting where we've recently lost $17 trillion out of the global economy? Can you help me make this argument to high-income countries that it's in our best interest to make this happen for low- and middle-income countries? Because
I think we can. I think that one of the things that we have to do is to have that discussion at many tables, many circles of influence. And I was at the Gates Conference. You've been to multiple international conferences, and I think we have to have clarity in our message and consistency in the message of what we are striving for and asking for. And part of it is clarity and empathy, almost in a sense of understanding that everyone deserves the opportunity to achieve health equity. So I'm going to switch gears just a little bit as we come to a close, because the Danforth Dialogues podcast really centers around leadership lessons. You were a leader sitting there at the NIH in the middle of a pandemic, and what you've been working on for many, many years was coming to fruition for potential as a solution that may become a little faster than you wanted to. What's the biggest leadership lesson that you learned during this pandemic?
Well, you've heard this before. I don't know who said it first, but one big lesson is that if you don't mind who's getting all the credit, you can. There's no end to what you can actually get done, especially in a government system. And Tony Fauci taught me this early on when I got there, that it may be hard to get into the government system, and it may be hard to figure out the government system. But once you're into the government system, it's also very hard to shut you down. And if you can get into that place where you have the resources and the freedom to do things, and then you're able to recruit people of like-minded people, people of goodwill, people who want to get things done in a purposeful, mission-oriented way, that, and then you're generous with who gets the credit, then there's no end to what can happen.
Thank you for that. And so finally, when we are facing major healthcare issues like COVID-19, we often say, many of us were saying this, would you please just let science lead? Would you please follow the science? But in order for science to lead, we need sometimes to have scientists who are leaders. I think you have represented that for us. But what advice would you give to this next generation of scientists who we are trying to also help them to be leaders?
Well, I'm excited for the next generation because I've seen what the technology can do, and I can see where it could take us if we would just let it. And so the young people, the 30-year-olds among us, the next 30 years for them is just going to be spectacular. What could be possible if we can... if we can also take the step of being willing to care for one another, to love one another, and if we can take that step and access all the scientific tools and resources we have now, we really could make this a better world. And so the young people have this huge opportunity. They also have a lot of challenges, and one of the big challenges is this politicization of biology and the effect of social media and misinformation on the uptake and confidence in science and confidence in medical institutions. And so I don't know how to solve that problem. So young people are going to have to use their social media skills, because I can access a few dozen people at a time. I talk to crowds of a couple hundred maybe, but they can access crowds of millions at a time. And so they need to use their skills in social media to do that education. And then we all need to be aware that we have a whole planet of young people who've experienced a pandemic, had to adapt and live through, and their schooling, and 7 and 8 year old children wondering what is happening to the world. And there's going to be a whole planet full of talented young children who've lived through this, who want to become viral immunologists.
All right.
And we need to open those doors for them and make sure there's ways for them to learn. Because as Barack Obama said, you can't win the game if you leave half of the team on the bench.
That's right. And we want all the students to be in the game.
We want everyone to be in the game. We do not want to leave talent unaccessed.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Graham. In closing, we always offer three thoughts on leadership. Today, we begin with great leaders know when to move on, but never stop moving forward. And I think our guest today is sharing that with us. He left the NIH after a long time there and moved along so that others could stand in his stead and reap the benefits of what he had worked on for so many years. There comes a time, and maybe several times, when we all have to realize it's time to move on. But even later in life, great leaders continue to make contributions that have positive impact on those around them. He's not going to get to recline in his easy chair because we have some things for him to do here at the Morehouse School of Medicine. Second, great leaders stay focused on the things they do best. They stay focused on the things they do best. When I look at great leaders, one of the things that stands out is that more than not, many of them keep doing what they do best for long periods of time. They just do it in different settings and in different ways and have different influence. And Dr. Graham is an example of that. And we know that our learners at Morehouse School of Medicine are going to really be the benefactor of the deep subject knowledge that you have and how you are translating that subject knowledge to health equity. And finally, great leaders always think beyond themselves. It's one of the things to say, I'm going to be focused on creating this new vaccine. I'm going to be focused on creating software programs. Or I'm going to be focused on creating this magnificent piece of art. But it's another thing to look beyond your creation, to understand the wider societal impact of the work that you do. Because great leaders know the work of each of us impacts the well-being of all of us. Thank you for joining us for this first edition in 2023 of the Danforth Dialogues. We are excited about our guest this year and hope you will tune in each month. As always, in closing, we wish you good health and great success in all that you do.
This has been a presentation of Danforth Dialogues with Morehouse School of Medicine President and CEO, Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. For more information, please contact us at danforthdialogues@msm.edu.